Welcome to the Speaking of Women's Health podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Holly Thacker, and I'm so glad to be back in the Sunflower House with our recurrent guest. She has the distinction of only being the first person I've invited back into the Sunflower House twice, and that's because she's so great, Dr. Abed, who sees patients with me on Thursdays in the Center for Specialized Women's Health. And she is a specialist in endocrinology and metabolism and diabetes and is a thyroid expert. And she went to medical school in the Damascus University School of Medicine in Damascus, Syria. And then she came to the United States to do an internal medicine residency at the prestigious Emory University Hospitals and School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. Then she came to Cleveland to do her endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism fellowship. And she's got a special interest in polycystic ovaries. And if you haven't heard our first podcast with her at the beginning of season two on PCOS, you should definitely listen to that. That was fabulous. And she's been in charge of our PCOS program for the last 7 years. And she is very talented, not just as a physician and a mother and a wife, but she has expertise in portrait and landscape photography. And we're going to feature some of her photography on Speaking of Women's Health. And she also is very talented. She just gave me this gift, which I love. Look at this jewelry box. For those of you on Rumble, and if you're not on Rumble and you want to see the audio visual of our interaction, go on Speaking of Women's Health. Just search for that on your Rumble app. Look at this mother of pearl. This is so beautiful, this jewelry box. I showed my granddaughter Artemis because she's already picked out Artemis, the jewelry that she's going to get and that her sister Beatrice is going to get when I pass on. So welcome, Dr. Ula Abed. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for the introduction. It's always a great introduction. How are you? It's been a good Friday. I had plenty of patients, very interesting patients today. How was your Friday?
Very busy. I just completed a whole day of virtual visits, which patients seem to like. Although the one thing about virtuals, which I think makes it, you know, easier for patients that are so busy and have so many responsibilities with elderly relatives and children and work responsibilities and home responsibilities, is you can't palpate the thyroid. And that's one thing I like to teach our fellows, to palpate, because I've picked up thyroid nodules and goiters. I mean, sometimes you can see them on people, and that's what today's podcast is doing. So is talking about is the thyroid, the master, you know, well, it's not the master gland, I guess the pituitary is, but it's an important gland. So tell us what the thyroid does and why it's so important for women and all people.
Right, right. So thyroid is that small little butterfly-like organ that sits in front of your it's a small superficial organ. However, it really controls your whole body. So it really controls your metabolism, your heart rate, your blood pressure, a lot of other things. It has to be in check all the time, because if things start getting, you know, too much thyroid hormone or too little thyroid hormone, you can be sick. So for women, especially, because, you know, women, they go through all these hormonal changes throughout their lives, number one. Number two, women are more likely, and it's more common for women to get thyroid problems. It's just way more common in women than in men to get thyroid problems, whether it's hypo, hyper, even thyroid nodules are way more common in women. So that's why it's very important.
Is that because we women have a higher rate of autoimmune disease since we have higher estrogen levels, and males, which generally have a lot more testosterone than women, that kind of dampens down the autoimmune system?
Probably, yes, yeah, because the most common disease for thyroid is Hashimoto, which is an autoimmune disease. The next one is, you know, Graves or thyroiditis. Those are also autoimmune diseases, and yes, they are more common in women. That's correct.
Can you have Graves and Hashimoto's?
So it's to answer this question, it's very interesting. Actually, you do, when you see a Graves or a Hashimoto patient and you ask about family history, many of these patients, they do have one family member that have Graves and the other one has Hashimoto. So most likely these antibodies coexist, But for some reason, one antibody would dominate and cause a problem in one person or in one sibling, and the other one causes a different problem or opposite problem in the other sibling. So they do coexist in patients, yes. So, I mean, you can't have both. You can have them one after the other. Like, you do see sometimes, rarely, Graves patient who would go through like destruction of whole thyroid and end up with hypothyroidism. So, but not at the same moment.
Interesting. And sometimes I'll see patients and I'll ask them, well, why are you low on thyroid? I see that you're on Synthroid or Armour or Unithroid or any thyroid preparation. And they'll just say, well, it's just low. And I'll say, well, do you have Hashimoto's? And they don't always know what I'm talking about. And then when I look at some endocrinologist notes, I see they don't always even do the thyroid antibodies. And is that because they just assume almost all low thyroid is Hashimoto's? And if the antibodies aren't there, the person's just burned out?
Right. Because it's the most common cause of hypothyroid in general is Hashimoto thyroiditis or, you know, autoimmune thyroiditis. So that's why we don't put a lot of pressure on, you know, what the antibodies are. The other thing is, sometimes when we check for antibodies, patients would like to know what these antibodies would become when they are under treatment. And that didn't prove to be important or significant at all. So titration of antibodies is not helpful. So even if you have really bad hypothyroidism and you are on like full replacement of thyroid hormone, your antibodies might be a little bit elevated versus someone else have level of antibodies in the hundreds and they only need 50, maybe 75 micrograms of thyroid hormone. So again, it's not a very helpful tool in general. I'm going to say in general because there are certain scenarios where you might really need to do the antibodies to distinguish certain situations. But most of the time, there's not too many clinical impact for antibody tests, for anti-TPO or microsomal antibodies.
And is there a benefit of antimicrosomal versus TPO, or are they pretty much similar?
They are similar. Uh-huh. They are similar.
Because sometimes when I type it in to order it, one comes up and sometimes the other, and I'm typing it the same way, and I'm just wondering why that is. The reason I tend to get it is because, I mean, I'll see women with premature ovarian insufficiency or pernicious anemia, or it seems like when you have one autoimmune disease, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, or sometimes it kind of correlates in women. And so if they have high antibodies, I just follow them maybe a little bit closer for other autoimmune conditions. And I push their vitamin D and try to help their immune system. I know that not everybody certainly does that. And some patients want more testing. Other people don't want testing, especially if they're having to pay out of pocket. So it kind of depends. But do you ever worry about like a lymphoma of the thyroid gland or something in someone who's got sky high antibodies?
And actually, there is a small study that was done that actually, if you have Hashimoto and you have some level of inflammation of the thyroid, you are less likely to get thyroid cancer.
Yes. Just like if you drink radioactive iodine to treat your overactive thyroid because you don't want to have surgery and you want to kill the gland. I have so many patients that are fearful of radioactive iodine that they're going to have cancer. And I tell them, no, actually, you have a reduced risk of thyroid cancer. Right. So I remember when I just joined the staff at the clinic and I had a patient with Graves, she didn't want surgery and she was otherwise healthy. And I calculated, she wasn't pregnant. I calculated out the dose for radioactive iodine and I ordered it. And then nuclear medicine called me, well, you're not on the endocrinology staff. You can't do this. And I'm like, well, I trained with Dr. Penn Skillern, who was the prior head of endocrinology. I know how to do this. And, you know, I know the precautions to give about not sharing utensils and double flushing the toilet and, you know, obviously not breastfeeding and all that. And so they were really upset. So I thought, well, I'm just going to have an endocrinologist in our center and so that they can handle that. But do you want to talk about that process of radioactive iodine, you know, versus giving medications versus having surgery and how that impacts, you know, maybe what a woman might want to choose just based on her age or childbearing or other factors like that?
Right. So we're talking now about hyperthyroidism and whether that comes from an autoimmune process like Graves' disease or a toxic nodule or toxic multinodular goiter. So yes, so treatment for those can be either let's talk about the ultimate, so surgery, like remove the whole thyroid gland. And we go there if we have like a really large goiter with a lot of nodules, or like a really large goiter. When I say goiter, I mean large thyroid gland with Graves. So either like full of nodules, really large, or like a large goiter with Graves that we don't think we can control with radioactive iodine or medications alone. So surgery would be a good option at that case. And the other modality is radioactive iodine ablation, as you said. And that's favored because it saves the patient surgery, of mm-hmm. course, unless they have, you know, a contraindication to radioactive iodine. And usually it's effective for both autoimmune Graves' disease or a toxic nodule. We try to give the least dose possible. And every year by year, they always try to, you know, improve the recommendation and say, you know, use the least dose possible to really minimize the exposure to radiation. And honestly, for these things, for hyperthyroidism, we're not talking about thyroid cancer. The doses we use for radioactive iodine are really low. Like the risk of cancer is really, really extremely low with these doses that we give. And of course, there are a lot of long list of precautions. So, for example, for Graves' disease or, you know, toxic goiter, they have to isolate for about 5 to 7 days. And anybody who comes to them should not come closer. And they need to leave within minutes and just, you know, give them food or whatever. They have to use their own bathroom, their own utensils, toothbrush, clothes, pile them up in like one pile, and then at the end of that week just put it in one load in the washing machine. Like, you know, we go through all that before giving the treatment. So that's radioactive iodine. And then we have the pill option, which is methimazole, which is a very old medication that has been used for forever for hyperthyroidism. We whether we decide to do surgery, radioactive iodine, or methimazole long term, we like to control things with methimazole initially. So no matter what we decide to do later, it's always good to control symptoms and get the patient under control with methimazole. It's a great drug. It does have some side effects, but most of the time patients tolerate it well, and sometimes they decide to stay on it for long term and maybe forever for controlling their hyperthyroidism.
And isn't there a risk of bone marrow suppression? So do you have to check blood counts regularly, or is that with PTU? Do you not use PTU, propylthiouracil?
So both PTU and so they do have the risk of agranulocytosis, and it's reversible. So we tell patients, if you start having any type of like upper respiratory infection or like a bronchitis kind of cold that doesn't go away in 3 days, go to the ER, ask them to get your white blood cell count checked. And if there is evidence of agranulocytosis, then stopping the medication does reverse the problem, and they improve. But that means they can't take any of these medications anymore. No methimazole, no PTU, because they cross-react.
Oh. So if someone chooses the radioactive iodine, which is probably what I think I would just choose as opposed to taking a chronic medicine, then your goal is to just make the gland normal, or is it to ablate it, and then you have to take a thyroid pill for the rest of your life always?
That's correct. Yes. So the goal is to just ablate the whole thyroid and give a replacement therapy for forever. Most of the time for Graves' disease, that's the goal. Yes. So success for radioactive iodine is when we see, you know, hypothyroidism happening, and then we start replacement. Yeah.
And do you choose surgery for someone who's like is too fearful for the radioactive iodine, or someone who's cosmetically concerned because things are so large and it's probably not going to shrink?
Yeah, exactly. So when, like, if I get a Graves patient who has really large goiter, and even with methimazole, we're not able to or barely controlling things, then I do know that that's a good candidate for surgery. Most likely radioactive iodine is not going to be enough to ablate it. And you don't want to repeat radioactive iodine and all that. So that is a good patient to send surgery. If you look at the guidelines, they say pregnancy, like if someone is thinking of pregnancy really soon, then yes, you don't want to expose them to radioactive iodine, because we ask for at least 1 year of no pregnancy after radioactive iodine. So that's another you know, scenario where you would send to surgery, not to radioactive iodine, if they are thinking of pregnancy very soon.
And is it true that most women with Graves are generally reproductive aged women, and in the postmenopause you don't see Graves as much?
You do see it. It's less likely and it's less intense, but you still see older women and men that come with, you know, brand new Graves' disease diagnosis. But usually younger people are more likely to get Graves' disease, and it's usually the symptoms are more intense in younger people.
Interesting. And what about some of the other manifestations that go along with Graves, like the exophthalmos when the eyes are more prominent? I thought I was reading there was recently a new medication that was FDA approved to treat that.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. So for exophthalmos, when we assess it in the clinic and we decide the patient has it, we do send to ophthalmology, and ophthalmology, they do have the infusion of the medication, and they do, like, they have a protocol for that infusion. So they want the patient to have certain level of exophthalmos, and they do it over certain number of courses or, you know, doses, and that proven to help with the exophthalmos problem. Back in the days, we used to use steroids, different things, but the new medication is, I don't want to say the brand name, but basically it's also, it really targets the antibodies that attacks the orbit, and that's how
it
works.
So it's precise, so it's pretty much precision medicine. Yeah. And does it help the myxedema or some of the changes sometimes that people have on the anterior lower front leg?
Well, I don't think that's well studied yet. I don't think that we know yet for sure that it does help with the with the myxedema. I don't think.
And I've had some patients who just choose to take PTU or methimazole, maybe a beta blocker to slow their pulse rate down if they've got good cardiac function and no other symptoms, and they, you know, try not to exert themselves and stress their body, and they wait, and sometimes it just passes and the thyroiditis is gone, and then they're not on anything, and they're like, see, I told you I shouldn't have had surgery. I shouldn't have had any radioactive iodine. Is there a way to figure out who might just have transient thyroiditis, like after pregnancy or delivery? Or
we'll be back after a quick break.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
So let's talk about, you know, autoimmune, like Graves' disease versus thyroiditis. So if we're talking about an autoimmune process, like a Graves' disease, and the patient, again, does not have a large goiter, and we put them on methimazole and they are well controlled, after 2 years, we do try to take them off and monitor. And we do have certain number of patients. I can't remember the right percentage, but it's about 20 to 30% of these patients, they do go into remission. And those patients we do follow without a medication every few months, their TSH, make sure it's okay. And some relapse and some don't. If a patient with Graves' disease with a large goiter, that is a patient, you know, who needs a lot of methimazole to control, that's a patient that I know they are not going to go into remission in 2 years. The patient, I would tell them, you know what, I'm going to control your symptoms with methimazole, but we do need a permanent treatment like radioactive iodine or surgery. Now, thyroiditis is a different story. So we try not to give methimazole to thyroiditis because we do know that it will go the other direction. It might just level out and be normal again, or it might go the other direction and be hypothyroid permanently. So we do control symptoms, though, with beta blocker or, you know, whatever. We want to give them for heart rate, other symptoms like a sleep aid, whatever. But we try not to give them methimazole in that hyperthyroid phase. Postpartum thyroiditis, I like to talk about it because I had it myself.
Baby one, baby two?
Because baby two. Yeah, so during both pregnancies, I was only on 25 to 50 micrograms for like subclinical, really, you know, just to support the thyroid. My TSH was like really borderline, like 3, 3.5, nothing major. And then after my second baby delivery, I was so happy. I was losing weight like crazy. It was so great. And then, because I was on Synthroid during pregnancy, I got my TSH checked. That was like 4 weeks after delivery. And of course it was very low. So my physician said, you know, stop your supplement. It's probably going to be just like the first pregnancy. You take it during pregnancy. You don't need it outside of pregnancy. And that's what I did. And he said, you know, let's check it again just to make sure it will go back to normal in 8 weeks. And I was like, oh, this is an overkill. Why would we check it again? And then 8 weeks later, I think I had a no-show in the clinic. I think I was at Women's Health. And then I was like, you know, let me just go and get my blood checked. And I go home and TSH was 50.
Oh, my.
50. And 54 was undetectable. And I was like, wow. I like going back, I start thinking about all the symptoms I was experiencing and not even thinking. So first of all, it's a silent thyroiditis. Like I had no neck pain or any kind of inflammation in the neck whatsoever. Everything was fine. My weight didn't go up, but the symptoms that I really was suffering from are cold, like my hands and feet. I never ever wear socks at home. And that winter, I wanted to get the thickest socks I can get my hands on and wear them all the time. And the other thing is I was feeling like I would wake up and then like 2 hours later I'm sleepy and I'm like, okay, I have a newborn and whatever, drinking caffeine one cup after the other, and I'm still not feeling that I am, you know, awake enough. And that was it. And once I started Synthroid, not right after, but like a week later, I was like, wow. Now I feel like I'm back to myself again.
Well, you've been listening to the Speaking of Women's Health podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Holly Thacker, and I'm interviewing an excellent endocrinologist, Dr. Ula Abed, who is just talking about her personal experience with postpartum thyroiditis. And that was with her second child, her daughter, who I understand at age 2 knows how to do makeup and likes to buy handbags every time she's out shopping with her mother. So she's got those girl activities down to a T so young, which is so great. But low thyroid can make people cold. It can I did an earlier podcast just in general going over the symptoms of overactive thyroid and underactive thyroid. And I talked about my sister who has Hashimoto's, who when she was low in thyroid, she could put her hand on the oven or grill and it wouldn't burn her hand because it was so thick and everything was just so slow and she was cold. So anytime something's off, whether it's hair thinning or weight gain or trouble sleeping or sleeping too much or constipation or high cholesterol, all those things could be a tip off. Most of the time it's not, but you know, it's better to check because you can be shocked with that, with the blood work. And I wanted to move in and ask you some questions because I previously went over a lot of the symptoms and standard treatment for low thyroid, which 1 in 8 women have. And, you know, most women do fine on Synthroid, which is T4, but not everybody does. And I wanted to find out, when do you prescribe Unithroid or Tyrosint or T3?
Yeah. So that's a great question because back in the days, and it's not long time ago, I would say just in the last probably 8 to 10 years, we start realizing that, yes, of course, when you treat patients, if we have, you know, one group of patients we treat with levothyroxine, the other group we treat with T3 in addition to T4 levothyroxine, yes, there is no superiority or both would achieve the same TSH goal and all that. However, there are certain number of patients who do not convert T4 to T3 on the cell level efficiently. Like they still convert it, but not as efficiently. So these patients, how would you know? You would put them, I would still say, you know, the first line treatment is levothyroxine. But say you give them levothyroxine, their TSH is optimal, and they are still having symptoms like mainly mental fogginess. So there is actually a recent data saying that that was the most reported symptom. And we hear this a lot, honestly, from patients who got thyroidectomy. Mm. So those patients are producing any T4 or T3. You do hear them that they say sometimes, not all of them, of course, but sometimes they say, you know, I, since surgery, I am not able to think clearly. And they refer it to as brain fogginess. That's what they call
it. Which midlife menopausal women have a lot of from not enough estrogen.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So that's the patient I would say, you know what, let's try to add T3 to your T4 and see if that helps. And yes, some patients do get better. But again, like, it's not every patient who did not lose weight on levothyroxine. It's not every still feel fatigued on levothyroxine. That's not the person. It's really that person who really noticed a major change after being diagnosed with hypothyroidism or after surgery, and mainly mental fogginess. That's the patient I would add some T3, back up a little bit on the T4 because you really want to keep the TSH balanced. That's the patient I would, you know, give them T3 or a combined T4, T3 pill. So, I mean, yes, that's, as I said, like, this is, you know, a certain case, but at the same time, I want endocrinologists and other physicians to be open to that, to the other formulation, because some endocrinologists are completely against, you know, armor thyroid or, you know, pig thyroid, desiccated thyroid replacement. I think we have to be open-minded and select the right patient and give them the combination that they need.
Yes. So interesting. I would say I find about 5% of my patients that plain T4 is not enough. So Synthroid is levothyroxine. Levothyroxine is the generic. And I used to be pretty specific. I want you on the brand name. But then all these pharmacy benefit managers came in and kind of rigged the system. And people have certain formularies. And cheap drugs like insulin and estrogen and thyroid just went sky high. It's just a shame. I've written a lot about it on Speaking of Women's Health, and I've done a podcast on how to save money on medicine. So I'd encourage anyone who didn't hear those in season 1 to go back. But it seems like the processing of the generics of levothyroxine has gotten better. So if you stick with the same brand, or not the brand, but the same company that's making the levothyroxine, do you endorse that?
Yes. So, you know, some patients, as you said, like, you know, some patients would do better on brand or generic or whatever, as long as it's the same thing or the same manufacturer, that's what matters. Because yes, sometimes when you switch from 100 micrograms of levothyroxine to 100 micrograms of Synthroid, TSH changes. Why is that? Well, you know, And sometimes it's the same generic form, but it's different manufacturer. So yes, I agree 100% that as long as you stay with the same kind of manufacturer, same, you know, brand/generic, then that would be great. Just stick with what you're mm-hmm. comfortable with.
And so if someone is allergic to dyes or gluten, is that when you pick one of these other ones like Tyrosin, which is so much more expensive?
So if I see a patient that has, you know, certain allergies or they like, yeah, like certain colors they put in the pills or filling. So for example, levothyroxine, the generic 50 micrograms is white, so it doesn't have any dye. So some patients prefer to take their full dose, whether it's 100 or 150 in 50 micrograms increments for that reason. So that's a possibility. The other one is I just saw a patient yesterday, actually, she gets hives. So that's a patient, like every time she takes her levothyroxine, that's a patient you would consider other formulations like Tyrosin, or, you know, just as I said, like build up the dose using the 50 mm-hmm. micrograms. So that's definitely a good alternative.
So does the generic levothyroxine use the same colors that Synthroid does? Because I always like patients to bring in their bottles. I want to see the bottle, see the pill, see the patch, see whatever, not look on the computer or look at the picture on my phone. I want to see it. But sometimes we look up, you know, the colors of the pills. Do they follow and track that?
So I honestly don't know if generic is using the same coloring, like the, oh, I see what you're saying, like the same coloring system. So like, yes, that's correct. So like 150 would be certain color for everything. Yes, that's correct.
They do.
And 50 is white. 50 uh-huh. is always white.
And as I was mentioning before we started to record, I have this a lovely patient a mutual patient, because I've sent her to you, of course, and she didn't really have any symptoms of low thyroid, but a woman and some autoimmune conditions. So I check her TSH, it's up, diagnose her with early low thyroid, she's got a family history, and put her on, you know, Synthroid T4, and she can't even tolerate like a TSH of 4 because there's an inverse relationship, which I go over on an earlier earlier podcast, that you really want your TSH around 1 or 2. You know, you don't want it too low because then you're overactive in thyroid like you were postpartum. But then you don't want it so high because that means your brain's trying to tell your thyroid, hey, get making some hormone. And she gets terrible insomnia. And I told her in all my years of practice, I hadn't seen that. And she's like, well, no, it's, you know, it happens to me and it's consistent, but I don't want to be low in thyroid. So is there ever a time you just follow the T4 or you just ignore the TSH? I know with antibodies and maybe special assays you might be able to do, or.
So that actually, now you're telling me the story again, that gets me to a very important point about diagnosing and treating hypothyroidism. So TSH has a wide range and we all live in that wide normal range, but every one of us have their own specific range that they are happy and their body are happy at. Meaning, like, for example, me before the postpartum thyroiditis, my TSH used to be 2 to 3, and that's my normal. You might have a normal TSH of 0.5. If I put you at TSH of 3, you will not feel well. So when a patient is having symptoms with a TSH of 5, then when I treat her and bring the TSH down to 2, she might feel better. Your patient might be, her body might be just happy at TSH of 4 or 4.5, and I wouldn't push it any further unless she's planning for pregnancy. That's a different discussion. Mm-hmm. But if... So most of the patients that we see are exactly the opposite. They prefer lower TSH,
sometimes too much. And I tell them if you drop the TSH too much, it accelerates aging, puts pressure on the heart, makes the bones thinner. More money in your bank account might be better, but not more thyroid necessarily.
Right, exactly. So everybody has their own happy point. And sometimes we can find that point looking at TSH done 8 years ago or whatever. Sometimes we don't. So it really depends on like where they are feeling better, as long as we stay in the normal range. Like, we don't want to push it too much. We don't want the TSH to be 10 either. As long as we stay in the normal range, everybody has their own.
So you would accept a TSH of 5 or 6, even if the T4 is fine and there's no other symptoms?
Yes.
So maybe I'll tell her maybe she needs to cut back a little bit just to see if that helps her sleep better. It's just interesting. Everybody's so individual. And over the years, I've seen women, they will not give up their armor thyroid. And it reminds me of the corollary in menopause. There's some women who will not give up their Premarin. Premarin is, you know, from horse's urine. It's got 10 estrogens in it. And I think there's some component that really lifts the mood and energy in some people. And they just don't want to give it up, which is fine because it's got breast benefits, bone benefits. I'm fine to prescribe, you know, Premarin to lots of my patients. But it's interesting with armor, because if you get a little bit too much, then you age faster. And I know a lot of endocrinologists don't like it, but it sure seems like there's a subset of people that must be the right formulation for them.
That's true. And again, I am happy with it as long as the TSH is happy with it. Like, if you want to take armor or pig thyroid or pork thyroid or Westroid, whatever.
There's different types. Like, do you recommend pig or is it just only from pigs, or do they get it from cows, or is there any other source?
So what we know is they get it from pig. That's the desiccated thyroid formulation. And I am happy with anything that would not upset the TSH again. So So I'm happy with like, sometimes I see these patients, they come with like super high dose of a T3 and like minimal T4. Well, that's not natural. You really need to think about. So the thyroid itself in normal cases produces 13 molecules of T4 to 1 of T3. So it's 13 to 1. 13 to 1. So you can't go give more T3 than T4. You really have to give more T4 than T3. So, but you don't have to think about all these things. If the dose is reasonable, like yes, T4 is more than T3 and the TSH is fine, it doesn't matter the formulation.
Well, sometimes I've recommended to patients, if you really want to be pure, and like some people are, you know, animal activists or they're vegetarian, and so they wouldn't take any animal products. Other people don't have a problem. Like I have some equestrians who will not take Premarin, even though I think they treat the horses just fine. And it's a natural substance, and we've used it for 70 years. But, you know, everybody's different, and I respect everybody's, you know, personal values and choices. And it's lovely that we have lots of options in medicine. But I frequently will recommend if someone's T3 is low and they just don't quite feel right, that you use a tiny bit of Cytomel, which is T3. And I see endocrinologists doing that, but a lot of times I only see them ordering it in the morning, but it's got a short half-life. So shouldn't you dose it a second dose in the afternoon, or you just don't want to rev people up at night?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When we check T3, we have to know if the patient took it that morning or not. So T3 has a short half-life. It's about 12 to 18 hours. So when we want to check it for certain reason, then we have to know what the patient mm-hmm. did that day. And we do sometimes dose T3 twice a day. However, we try to minimize the T3 only because there are receptors for T3 on the atria, on the mm-hmm. cardiac atria. So you're really getting stimulation of that heart directly when you're giving T3. So we minimize the dose, like we say, just take it in the morning, assuming, you know, people in the afternoon, it's time for rest and all that. So, but yes, it does have a short half-life, and when you check it, you have to know what your patient did that day. I wouldn't prescribe it solely because T3 is low if the TSH is okay. But if the TSH is high and then the T4 is not great and then they have some deficiency in T3, then I would start with levothyroxine first, T4 first, and then if they are still symptomatic, then maybe add some T3 mm-hmm, on top mm-hmm. of it.
Now, I imagine patients must ask you all the time, well, why is my thyroid sick? Overactive, underactive, has a nodule, has this, has that. Is there anything people can do other than eating a healthy diet and getting iodized salt, which is generally most salt is iodized, although if you're on the pink Himalayan salt, that's just potassium. There's no iodine in it. And I was using kosher salt for years because it's more granular and I just, you know, like to cook with it, but that's not iodinated either. So, Are you seeing people from certain parts of the world that truly are iodine deficient and that's why they have goiters, or is that anything for people to be worried about?
Usually not in the US, but yes, in other parts of the world, you could see, you know, iodine deficiency causing a goiter or hypothyroidism, especially in certain circumstances. So pregnancy is one of them. Like you need a lot of iodine with pregnancy. So sometimes that doesn't show up until you're pregnant, but usually not, again, not in the US. We do have really good sources of iodine. The salt, bread usually is fortified with iodine. Back to your question about, you know, healthy lifestyle, less stress, good amount of sleep and all that. There are good reports to say selenium does help the thyroid health and decrease the inflammation in the thyroid. Now, you know, it's not going to reverse Hashimoto, but it's going to probably make the inflammation better, or maybe prevent having Hashimoto to start with if you're, you know, getting in selenium. And that usually exists mostly in Brazilian nuts, in general in nuts, but mostly in Brazilian nuts.
I should go have some Brazilian nuts for a snack then. I thought that our soil in Ohio is relatively rich in selenium. So like, I don't usually tell people to supplement with selenium. And sometimes I see people on high doses, they go to functional medicine, they get all these supplements. And I thought the you want 100 micrograms, but 200 is like, it's not antioxidant, it's pro-oxidative. So any comments? Do you ever check selenium levels? Do you say buy local?
No, I know. I really don't. And I just tell them, you know, take over the counter, like 100 of selenium, or just, you know, take Brazilian nuts, but there is no good data to say this amount is enough or this amount is too much. Or again, like, it's not every patient with Hashimoto that I would recommend that unless I get asked, but maintaining healthy, wide variety of healthy diet and a healthy lifestyle in general does help with any sure. autoimmune disease.
And usually always check people's vitamin D levels because it's linked to so many different diseases.
Yeah.
And I really think that helps the immune system and reduces cancer. And this has been such a great conversation. I'm going to have to book you again in the future to talk about thyroid cancer and thyroid nodules and other things that we didn't get to. We do have an excellent free Cleveland Clinic treatment guidebook on thyroid disorders, which people can get on speakingofwomenshealth.com. One last question I have for you, because I've had patients ask me this, and I don't know if it's because of all the worldwide conflict and fear about World War III, but I've had patients ask me, doctor, you know, should I get some potassium iodide tablets to have on tan in case there's some nuclear disaster? Or some people live near nuclear plants because, you know, they want to take a certain dose and to protect their thyroid in case there is some sort of nuclear disaster.
So that's a great question that I did not expect.
I just thought of it because, you know, I had someone ask me the other day.
But back in the days when I started working, I actually was serving a clinic in Madison, Ohio. And in that area, they do have a close by nuclear plant. And they did, I mean, many patients did tell me that when radiation levels were a little bit higher, whatever, the government would give them potassium iodide tablets to take for like a week or whatever. So I did hear that from patients, but I mean, nobody should stock on that unless we really have, you know, like an official discovery of, you know, leak of radiation or something. I really hope this never happens.
Oh, no. I really do too, scary. But I know you could order it pretty cheaply online. I'm not going to say the big company that everybody orders things online from that comes to my door almost every day because I'm always ordering things.
Right.
But I imagine it has to be dosed right, and you really would need some sort of official guidance, especially for breastfeeding women or babies or, you know, adults.
Right.
But hopefully it won't ever come to that. But it's interesting that that is protected and does seem to repel some damage. Just like if you were going to drink radioactive iodine for your Graves, you wouldn't want to take potassium iodide tablets, right? Because that would interfere.
Right, correct. Right. So let me just explain something. Like if someone try to sell you iodine or iodide tablets to take as a supplement to support your thyroid, please don't. Because as you said, Dr. Thacker, too much iodine does suppress the thyroid function completely. And that is why, as you said, when we give radioactive iodine, we tell them to be on like iodine free diet for a week and whatever, because we really want that thyroid to be deprived of iodine. So active, it will uptake it really well, so it would kill the thyroid gland. So yes, don't take extra iodine. Extra iodine is not good for
good.
You.
Well, that is just so excellent. And I just really want to thank Dr. Ula Abed, an endocrinologist at the Cleveland Clinic. And she's written some great columns on our speakingofwomenshealth.com. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. And I promise I'll have this fascinating smart physician back again. And if you want to support the podcast, please share it with others. You can donate to our nonprofit on speakingofwomenshealth.com and leave us a 5-star rating if you would. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And thanks again. And I'll see you back again in the Sunflower House.